Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention a bit to mental health today and in kind of a specific area. You may be somebody who cares or looks after an older family member or one perhaps who's in declining health. You may, if you don't, you may know somebody who is. And of course, the concern is about the person who is needs the care, the person who may be ill or have mental health issues. But we sometimes don't spend enough time thinking about those caregivers, the ones who give care to those who need it. Great to have back Dr. Shyla Morgain, a distinguished psychologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She's also a sports psychologist for UW Badger student athletes. She does a lot in many areas, and she's been with us a number of times over the years, and great to have her back. What about you? I hope you'll join in. Are you in that position right now or know somebody who is in a position of having to help someone else? I hope you'll call in with your experience. Give a call, the number 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Shyla, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
Well, life expectancy in the U.S. has increased dramatically, and I'm seeing a growing percentage of Americans 65 or older, almost to the point of surpassing children, outnumbering children.
That's true. We have the baby boomers and people who are aging that often at some point may experience a significant medical issue that they're unprepared for. And that can be a challenge for loved ones who are involved in just their care or their support.
And I think most people who do it, they might do it out of love and fulfillment. But it's, I think, pretty stressful and draining.
Absolutely. Being diagnosed with a serious medical issue really creates a seismic shift in your life and can really rock the foundation of your family and how you're spending your time. And I think we're never really prepared personally to receive that diagnosis, and especially for a loved one, I think it can be really challenging and complex and overwhelming, and people often don't know how to best support loved ones going through medical treatment.
I was wondering how well are family members equipped for that kind of commitment?
Often not very, and many people can feel like they just don't know what to say, and not everyone can deal with somebody having a medical issue. It can bring up a lot of discomfort or anxiety, and so people inadvertently can start to distance at the time where people really need your presence. And so I think some practical strategies of how to best communicate support at the initial diagnosis and going forward can be really helpful, giving people a roadmap or blueprint on how best to support those loved ones.
So let's talk about some of those, that blueprint. Let's put it that way.
Great. I really think about the first thing is not to be afraid to talk about it. Sometimes we want to avoid talking about it, and we talk about everything else, like the weather. And so, you know, we don't need to know exactly what to say, but to just bring it up and say, you know, please know how much I care, or what can I do for you, or I'm always here if you want to talk. Or even just a phrase like, I'm so sorry this is happening to you, but, you know, I don't even have the words to express the heartfelt care and concern I have, but I'm here. And to keep going and talking about it and asking them specifically, what can I do for you? What support do you need? And they may have ideas you hadn't even thought of, but certainly we know people do better with a medical condition whether it's chronic or something seismic like a stroke, but they do better when they feel that support from people around them. And you can just be that support in just regular communication. It could be a phone call, it could be a visit, it could be a text, it could be old-fashioned mail, but a little bit of checking in goes a long way.
So an elderly patient, and I've had this own experience in my own life, an elderly patient can lose the ability to even recognize the caregiver, even when that person is maybe a child or a brother or a sister. For that caregiver, what does the caregiver, how does a caregiver get through this?
Well, I first think there's grief around the loss of that person's functioning, their memory, their quality of life, and it can be quite painful. So recognizing this is really hard, and it's meant to be hard. And then second, figuring out ways of staying connected. It might be going and visiting that person in memory care and holding their hand. Or I know when my grandfather had Parkinson's and was losing his memory, I brought him his favorite chocolate box. And although he wasn't quite recognizing me fully, man, did he enjoy those chocolate turtles. And he had a big smile. And so whether it's your presence or bringing something or playing music for that person or certainly advocating for their care, checking in with staff, making sure that how they're taking their medication, do they have their favorite cozy socks or blankets? But that kind of presence, I think research shows that if we're involved in their care, they often that care improves because they know somebody is checking in on them, looking out for them.
Yeah, yeah. And for the caregiver himself or herself who is actually providing that, I mean, as you look at someone else, I mean, how do you help that caregiver?
So I think there are a couple things to keep in mind. First, you have to care for the caregiver. That I've seen sometimes care for loved ones can feel so all-encompassing that you start to feel depleted and drained. And so it's important to take time away to recharge. Make sure you're doing something every day for your own care. I think it's also, we can't do it alone. I think other cultures have much more of a community mentality where everyone's chipping in. In the U.S., it can be more individualistic. And so sometimes it can feel like a great burden if you're the only one there to provide that care. So making sure you're getting support from friends, family. You might tell them what you need. Maybe you need a home-cooked meal once in a while, or somebody to run an errand for you, or somebody just to go out with a movie and do something fun. I also think it's really important to tap into resources that are there, such as social work, or there are organizations that can provide support, like Meals on Wheels, for example, there are organizations and communities and healthcare providers like in-home nursing that you can set up that not everything's falling to you. And I think it's also important to pace yourself, that maybe some days you go, you're doing everything, and then other days maybe you need to outsource it or get other people, other family members, other friends in to help.
Dr. Shyla Merghain, our guest today, we're talking about those who need care and the caregivers who could use some help as well. I hope you'll join in with your own experience. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Shyla Merghain. She's a distinguished psychologist in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at caregivers and those who need the care. And you can join in. 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Let's take a call from Jeff in Pelican Lake. Jeff, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
My girlfriend is a legal guardian for 9 people. And there is a want and need in northern Wisconsin, or I would imagine all over the state of Wisconsin, for legal guardians. We have one person that's in an Alzheimer's unit. We have another one that's in hospice care. The remainder are in homes around northern Wisconsin where they get 24-hour care, but their relatives have no contact with them, or they have no relatives. But this is a profession that they need people. She's 80 years old. Who's going to take care of her?
Yeah. Wow. Nine.
Nine people. That's very inspiring. And Jeff, thank you for calling in to really reflect what your girlfriend is doing and the plug for others to consider becoming legal guardians, because there is a big need that many people, as they age, find that either their relatives, loved ones are no longer living, or there's been some distance, and a loneliness can be pretty significant. And it's wonderful to know that even if that we can offer help in that way to others.
So, yeah, and if you've got a relative who's 1,000 miles away, well,
right.
You're not going to—so a legal guardian— I mean, it sounds like this person, it's almost a profession for this person.
Absolutely. It can be.
And she's got nine because there's no one else to.
Yeah, there's a great need, I think.
It would be interesting to know how Jeff supports her. And you may not be prepared to even know this, but legal guardian, is there a way that anything, any kind of training or not?
It probably depends state by state. But I think there needs to be probably some background checks and things like that to get hired as a paid legal guardian.
Well, Jeff, your partner, your girlfriend is doing great work that I wish more people could find the stamina and the caringness to take part. Thank you very much for calling. Michael and Marinette, we'll go to you. Hi, Michael.
Hi. My concern is for somebody I've observed taking care of his mother. He passed away. Then he took care of the father. He passed away. And just recently, his younger brother, and he's passed away. So he's kind of gone through all this. Me as an outsider, I'm concerned for his mental health, especially. And I'm not sure how to go about trying to offer him something. You know, he's kind of done it all on his own.
Yeah. Well, I know people like that, Michael. What can Michael do to help his friend who has gone through all this and now is in maybe some mental health crisis of his own?
That's really significant losses to lose both your parents and then your brother and being involved, it sounds like, in their day-to-day care. And, Michael, it sounds like you're a great friend to be calling in and thinking about, what can I do to support this friend? You know, you could think about a couple different things. You could think about asking him what he missed out on during all those years that he would like to return to. Maybe it's fishing. Maybe it's a card game. Maybe it's going out to eat. And then maybe plan some of those things that you could really look forward to and he would really enjoy, and a treat that he hasn't been able to do. I'm sure your friend is grieving, and there's also a new normal for him as he's orienting his life not around caregiving but back to his own life. And so sometimes people forget even who they are. They lose parts of their identity when so much of their time, energy, and focus is on caregiving. So I think you could also just lend a supportive listening ear to hear about what his experience was like with caregiving, what he does miss, some of those memories of those times with his brother and parents where he really enjoyed those memory maker moments, and just lend that kind of listening ear and just get curious about what this new normal is and this next phase of life. It sounds like there's a lot of space and opportunity for him to create this next chapter of his life, and you certainly want to be there for him.
And so talk to him about it, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 Just get curious, listen, continue to listen, and provide support just by listening.
And maybe some things that they could do together.
Absolutely.
Get him out of the house. Michael, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Kathy in Middleton. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was a caregiver for my husband for 2 years. He had a terrible bike accident and became a quadriplegic, so I know the caregiving role really well. And my comment is for people that know caregivers. Instead of asking, what can we do, just do things. I had good friends that sent a maid service over. They started a meal train for us. They had me over for pizza, all kinds of things. Because when people ask you what they can do, it's hard to come up with things. Even though there's a million things people could do, you just feel like you have it all under control, you're just going to keep doing this. But if people just do it, it is so helpful, and then you can't say no.
Oh, Kathy, that's pretty well said. Shyla?
I love that, Kathy, and thanks for giving people permission to just do it, because I think you're correct. If you ask, what can I do? Sometimes people feel guilty for asking or feel like they should handle it all themselves, or, you know, it's hard to keep asking, what can I do? So you're giving some really concrete suggestions of meal train, go over, do their dishes, run some errands for them, sit with the loved one so that person can get out of the house, and or just something as simple as taking a shower or going to their own medical appointment. So there are concrete things, and just giving them a break, helping lighten their load, it really is just great support for those caregivers.
Denise in Appleton called to say she has a father in need of care while she is balancing that with child care. Sometimes has complicated relationships with a parent you're caring for, mostly out of obligation. So here we have somebody who's may not have had the best of relationships with a parent, and now she is. And she has, at the same time, feeling an obligation. She's got to put you in a bind.
Absolutely. And I don't think Denise is alone in that. Sometimes we land in the caregiver role not because we are choosing to, but because we have to, and if we don't do it, no one else will. And Denise is in that sandwich generation of caring for young kids, but also taking care of her parents. And I think a couple things, you know, boundaries, respecting your own boundaries and your own limitations, and this notion that you can't pour from an empty cup. So it's important to figure out the things I have to do, but then maybe there's some things that you can delegate or even sometimes not do, so you can return to your own life, because I think otherwise it's easy for resentment to build up. And I think any way you can maintain some normalcy in your own life with your own family, some of those hobbies or routines that you do, I think are really, really important. And again, I think there is a lot of support for caregivers. For example, the Family Caregiver Alliance is a great organization to provide additional resources to support loved ones and yourself in navigating this kind of complex situation. The Family Caregiver Alliance.
Oh, and that's is that a volunteer kind of thing?
It is online. They have excellent educational materials.
Very. Family Caregiver Alliance, Denise. You might want to look that up, because they're probably, it's probably a situation where the folks that are in that alliance have gone, have people in it who are going through exactly what Denise in Appleton is going through.
Absolutely.
I'm betting. So I hope you'll take that into account. Family Caregiver Alliance. Wow. You know, it feels like we're just getting started, and here we are at the end of our half hour. And you had a question for me.
I did, Larry. So, you know, you're in this point of retiring shortly after 59 years and a tremendous legacy you've created at WPR. And at retirement, there's a developmental milestone of stagnation versus generativity. And so I see you, somebody, as being very generative. And in retirement, there's also a concept called de-aging, that our body may age, but our spirit, soul, can become more vital and alive. So I'm wondering, what is one thing that you'll do to have that generativity and that kind of vitality and that de-aging as you go into this next chapter?
Well, one thing I will be doing, and I've been doing this as well, is I'm on a board of an early learning center, and I've been very active with that group, because I think it's an important, the early learning centers are typically, at least in our case, there are way more people who need the care, young people, than we have the room for. So one of the things we'll be doing is building in some additions to the early learning center for the different age groups that you, everything from infants to four-year-olds. And I'll be very active on the building committee for that. So that's one thing. And just and another service group that I belong to works a lot with children in need. And I've always enjoyed working with young people. I've taught my whole life, and it's a way to kind of keep that going and keep me going in a positive direction.
Amazing. Very meaningful, purposeful work that I really admire and respect. And we're excited to see this next chapter. And I know you'll still be around at here and in our community. Thank you for everything you've done and
well,
your
thank
legacy.
You. Thank you, Shyla. And I'm sure you're going to, I'm hoping you're going to agree to continue to be on the show.
I would love to.
It's always great to have you here. Dr. Shyla Mergane, distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And coming up, we're going to be taking a look at stroke. What is it? Can you avoid it? And many more things to talk about with our next guest, Dr. Diane Book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we turn our attention to stroke. If you've suffered a stroke, I know the experience, very scary. Often you're unable to communicate your distress, let alone identify the cause. And that's why I think it's important for people to be able to identify the symptoms and seek medical help immediately. And I'm Larry Mueller, by the way, and we'll be talking about that today with Dr. Diane Book. Dr. Book is a neurologist specialist in cerebrovascular disorders, including stroke, and a co-founder of the Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin Stroke Program. It's great to have her with us. And as we talk, I hope you'll join in maybe you've suffered a stroke, or maybe you know someone who has. I know I have a couple of them. I have a good, very good friend who had a stroke. My dad had a stroke. It's out there, and most of us know somebody who's had to go through this. Give a call, though, with your own experience at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Diane Book, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Larry. Super happy to be here. I really love talking about stroke and educating people.
Let's start with a definition. What is a stroke?
Oh, so a stroke technically is the injury in the brain, a small area usually where blood flow has been lost and the brain cells die. So the brain injury is what we call the stroke.
The brain injury. And there are different types of strokes, as I understand it?
Positively. So there's two main categories of stroke. There's the most common, and it's the type of stroke we're usually referring to, because it's 80 to 90% of all strokes are an ischemic stroke. So that's the word that means lack of oxygen. So that's when there's a small blood vessel in the brain that is blocked, clogged, or occluded, and the patch of brain supplied by that artery, we're talking arteries usually, dies. And that's an ischemic stroke, the most common kind of stroke. The other kind of stroke, less common but a little more dangerous, is a bleeding stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke, where the blood vessel, the artery, breaks open and leaks blood, as opposed to having a clog. So an analogy I think that we'll probably come back to a few times here is to use a plumbing analogy. So we're talking about plumbing to the brain. So supply of blood and oxygen in the blood. And your pipes, of course, do that in your house, delivering water. And you can have a clog in the pipe and no water gets through, that's ischemic, and you can have a broken pipe or water spilled everywhere, and that's a hemorrhage.
Oh, man. Yeah, and, well, you don't want either one, but I guess...
No, of course. Yeah.
If you're going to have one, the ischemic sounds like the preferred version of a stroke to have.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's problems with each of them that are slightly different, but... Hard to argue that a hemorrhage is favorable. Yeah, hemorrhages are harder to treat. There are fewer treatment options. So,
my dad had a stroke on the golf course. It was an ischemic stroke, I believe, and he lost his voice for a while.
Oh, like slurred speech or couldn't make sound at all?
Well. Very slurred.
Yes.
And that was, and he, over time, he liked to fish, and he'd go out in his boat by himself, musky fishing, and he would work on his voicing, because I think he would have been embarrassed to be trying that sort of thing around everybody. And of course, mother would jump in the boat with him too. And
yeah.
And
so that's a super common phenomenon is, you know, they have pride and you've lost some ability in a stroke and people don't like to either share that or manifest that. But we'll probably get to talking about recovery after stroke. And the best thing you can do is challenge yourself to be out there and doing the thing that's hardest for you. Because the more you do, the faster you do it, the sooner that is after a stroke, the more you're going to get back. So I would be counseling your dad. He's got to get out in public and talk.
Yeah. Well, he did. He was able to, I mean, he still had a little, he wasn't quite the same as his old self, but pretty close. But
good.
That's one effect. I mean, there are other long and short-term effects of strokes we could talk about.
Right. And recognizing stroke, and there's an acronym that's very popular and we strongly promote it called BFAST, because it talks about what are common signs of stroke, and also then those are going to be the common effects of a stroke. So if we want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, let's do that.
So it's BEFAST, BFAST, which stands for the most common impacts of a stroke. Now, guidance. So a stroke can hit any part of the brain. And most strokes hit one part of the brain at a time. So one stroke is one patch of brain that's damaged. So the specific symptoms, like your dad's slurred speech, completely depend on where in the brain the stroke occurred. So every stroke is different. And any particular neurologic deficit is possible in a stroke. The BFAST guide is the most common things that happen in a stroke, but many other things can happen. So the B stands for sudden loss of balance. The A stands for sudden eye problems, E for eye, as in a vision change. It can be loss of vision in one eye or loss of vision to one side. F is for facial droop. A is for arm weakness. S is for speech difficulty, which it sounds like your dad may have experienced. And T stands for time. You got to act fast, call 911, and get yourself to an emergency room. And in the newest iteration of this, T also stands for terrible headache, which is a common feature of that less common hemorrhagic stroke. So the ischemic strokes, again, that's 85% of strokes, do not cause pain. So headache is not a typical feature of an ischemic stroke, which in my career I've found to be a tragedy because it doesn't hurt, people don't act as quickly. And the analogy is heart attack. Heart attack is the same problem, but in the heart. A patch of heart muscle loses its blood supply, causes exquisite pain, you know, the pain of angina, chest pain, heart attack, and then people get themselves to care because it hurts. And stroke usually doesn't hurt, which is one of the reasons people delay. But the hemorrhage strokes do hurt, so that's a terrible headache.
Yeah. The foursome behind my dad in the golf course, one of them was a physician and ran right up there and and my dad was in an ambulance and out the door off the course in pretty very quick time.
Excellent. That's what needs to happen. As when we get into treatments, you'll all hear me repeat that the faster we can get to that ischemic stroke and restore blood flow before those brain cells have died, that's really what we're trying to do, is reverse the stroke process, the more recovery you'll have. And we're talking minutes. I mean, millions of brain cells die every minute that the blood flow is reduced. So we got to get to you very quickly.
Hmm.
So he did the right, he and his golf group did the right thing.
Cheryl in Iron Ridge, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Well, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for my wonderful husband, who unfortunately died in 2024 of melanoma. But we were camping in Texas in our motorhome. I was cooking dinner and, of course, talking. And my husband, you know how when somebody gets put to sleep, you really don't know you're getting put to sleep till you wake up and realize the procedure is over?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that at that point I was slurring my words while I was cooking at the stove in our motorhome. My husband called the EMTs in our little town where we camped on our friend's ranch. And by the time the guys got there, I didn't know I had a stroke. I said, why are the EMTs here? And my husband looked at me and he said, you were having a stroke. And I said, no, wait a minute. I was cooking. I wasn't having a stroke. And sure enough, I had had a mini stroke because later in life, when I acquired AFib, they did all the tests, and Dr. Berger from Fraydert is my doctor. They found I had a stroke back then, but I didn't know I had a stroke.
Yeah. Very interesting. Dr. Buck, comment.
So that story is so common. If I had a nickel for every time I've heard a story like that, I'd be rich. So several key things you point out, and thanks for calling. Sounds like your speech is very normal, so I'm really glad you had a great recovery. But, yeah, you had a speech problem, you know, the S of the B fast, like Larry's dad. And you bring up an important point. A person having a stroke sometimes, not always, but sometimes is not aware of the problem. And part of that is because we're talking about a brain injury, and your brain may not be processing your insight properly. So the person who has a stroke isn't always aware they're having the stroke. It depends where in the brain the injury is happening. And then the second thing is they discovered in your evaluation, I presume, the AFib. Or maybe that was later. I couldn't quite follow the timeline. But AFib is a common cause of stroke, particularly in older people who are more prone to stroke. And most persons who present with AFib don't know that they've had it. So atrial fibrillation is an irregular heartbeat, doesn't necessarily cause any overt symptoms. You might not have palpitations, you might not have chest pain, you might not have anything wrong with you until you have a stroke because of the irregular heartbeat in the heart, which allows a little clot to form and then get kicked out into the brain. So when someone comes in with a stroke, there's a whole variety of tests we do to determine the specific cause, and we're always looking for AFib. So I'm glad they found your AFib, and I'm glad you've recovered from the stroke.
I am as well, Cheryl. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Robert in Amherst Junction, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi there. Well, a couple interesting kind of funny things happened when I had a stroke. One is that I came in the house really confused, and I described my symptoms, and my son was in high school at the time. Sitting on the couch with his computer, he said, he's having a stroke. Get him in the emergency room. Because he had some program at the high school where they told him what the symptoms were. But then when I got to the hospital, there was a question of whether or not they could administer the clot buster medication. Because you have to do it within a certain amount of time. And I didn't know what time it was when I had the stroke out in the shop. But I said, click and clack, the Tappet Brothers had just come on the radio. And so they looked up the time and discovered that, I was under the threshold where I could get the medication.
So a public radio connection.
Right. Thanks to public radio.
That's a great story. That is a great story. And, you know, you remind me to mention that last letter in the Be Fast time. It also means that specific time when your symptoms start is critical. We need to know exactly when the clock started on that potential stroke because, yes, the clot-busting drug we give, it's now called TNK, or tenecteplase. We have to give it under a certain time window. It's 4.5 hours in most people. And if we don't know the time, and if it's possible that the time was longer than that 4.5 hours, we cannot give it. So like if somebody wakes up in the morning with the symptoms and they went to bed at 10 o'clock the night before, we can't give it because we can't be sure they didn't have it all night. And in your case, there were clues. So we are always probing and probing for, well, what were you doing? What was happening? When do you have your lunch? When do you go in the shop? And right, if you listen to a show, that's time stamped. So we know that at least at that point, we can start figuring out the clock. So we're always digging like detectives in the heat of the moment in the emergency room to figure that out.
So if, and Robert, thanks so much for calling. I very much appreciate that call. So if you don't know the time, then what's the alternative in terms of care from your point of view?
So if we don't know the time, and if the last, so we look for when were you last known to be well. The last known well time is the time we have to use. So let's say Robert says, well, I went into my shop, but I don't know when this started, but I talked to my wife in the morning during breakfast, so we have to use that as the start time. And if the start time is beyond 4.5 hours, we have to look to other more aggressive options than the clot-busting drug. But really, we'd like to be able to give that clot-busting drug to every stroke patient, ischemic stroke, because it's quick, it's easy, it's just a IV push in the emergency room, and it's highly effective. If it's beyond the 4.5 hours, the other options we have are, catheter-based treatments where we go in with a little wire into the artery in the groin or the arm, and we feed that wire up to the brain. We find the clot directly, and we drip medicine or we pull it out with a little bit of plumbing tools to do what's called thrombectomy. That's much more complicated, much more risky, but we can do that out to even 24 hours.
An emailer wonders, can signs of stroke differ between men and women? This person has heard that signs for women aren't as talked about, so many women wait longer to get treated.
So heart attack symptoms vary greatly between women and men. That's the newer data in the last few years that's been very revealing. Stroke is not quite so gender unique. So we're talking small areas in the brain. The brain works similarly, in most humans. So we don't really see dramatic differences between men and women in how stroke symptoms present.
If somebody has had a stroke, are they at a greater risk of having another one?
Yeah, so the answer is yes. So, I mean, imagine a stroke is really a manifestation in most cases of some kind of plumbing problem. Your pipes are damaged, getting plaque and build up and clogged, or you have a problem with your water, your blood, meaning a clotting disorder that's rare, or you form clots in the heart. So those problems are all things that can't be cured per se. They can be treated and managed, but not cured. So yes, you always have a risk for another stroke, and about a third of all stroke patients go on to have another stroke. So really most of the care I have to deliver in a hospital or in the clinic when I meet a person who's had a stroke is helping figure out what are the specific things we can do to prevent a second stroke.
Yeah. And what are some things that we can do to prevent that second stroke?
So it's all related to keeping your plumbing clean. So there'll be medications prescribed for preventing certain varieties of blood thinners, aspirin being the most common thing we'll use. But in every person, and this is whether you've had a stroke or have never had a stroke, so hopefully most of the people listening have never had a stroke, you want to, be an active
participant in keeping your body healthy, which means keeping blood pressure low, keeping blood sugar low, keeping weight low, keeping cholesterol down, not smoking, and being physically active. Those are all things that prevent a stroke in the first place and will secondarily reduce your risk of a future stroke if those things haven't been already in check. But medications are also used as blood thinners. We'll treat cholesterol. We'll treat diabetes and high blood pressure quite aggressively. And then in some cases, we have to treat concurrent heart disease if that was the root cause of the stroke, like our caller who had atrial fibrillation.
And I have the friend I had that had AFib, and that was the reason for his stroke, which he's completely recovered from many years back already. But still, that's in the background for sure. What's a stroke center certification? What is that? And who should get it?
Oh, hospitals can apply for certification by the Joint Commission, which is a federal agency, but there are other organizations who'll certify hospitals. And that's a long process of basically proving that you have all the right elements of care at your institution and meet certain standards of quality to deliver stroke care. It initially came out when the clot-busting drug TPA first came out, which was in the late 90s. And we wanted patients to know which hospital has this drug, which hospital can safely deliver this drug. So they started certifying hospitals as being basically competent to deliver this drug. So ambulances would know which hospitals to take a stroke patient to and maybe which hospitals should be bypassed because the patient's not going to get this emergency care. It's a lot like, you know, by analogy, the certification of trauma centers. So a stroke center that's certified has proven and has a track record of being able to deliver the full complement of care options and to do so with high quality.
Which Frater has?
All the Fraters that are full hospitals, so Maine, Fratert, Fratert West Bend, Fratert, Menominee Falls are all the highest level of certification, which is referred to as a comprehensive stroke center, which means we can do all the types of treatment I've mentioned, the clot-busting drugs and the more aggressive thrombectomy treatments.
Wow. A good place to go if you're in that situation, for sure. Where do people go for more information about strokes and stroke recovery?
So there's lots of resources out there. I would say the American Heart Association and a subdivision of that American Stroke Association is a fantastic resource for patients, for caregivers, and for health professionals. And then the National Stroke Association is another similar organization. And then in the hospitals themselves put out a lot of information. The Fraidert.org website has a whole series of, I guess you'd call them pages, that cover stroke care and stroke recovery.
All good information, and you mentioned the American Heart Association. That's a simple one, too. It's just stroke.org, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Stroke.org.
Well,
I go there often.
Well, Dr. Book, it has been a great pleasure talking with you. I probably won't be able to talk with you again because I'll be retiring in June, but Lee Rayburn, who's taken over for me, I'm sure is going to want to talk with you again. Thank you so much for being with us, and look forward to another visit from you. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Larry, and to your great callers.
Dr. Diane Book, co-founder of the Fraidert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Stroke Program, specialist in cerebrovascular disorders. Coming up, Dr. Zorba Pastor for the next hour. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Go ahead and take a look at public health in Wisconsin today, kind of fairly broadly, with our guest, Dr. Zorba Pastor. Zorba, retired physician, author, former host of Zorba Pastor on Your Health here at WPR, nationally syndicated. He now has a new podcast called Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And if you haven't heard that yet, you should.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's great. It's wonderful. I love doing it. I love doing the podcast with curated medical information. Right. Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. We've got 78,000 monthly listeners right now subscribed, and we're hoping to make that to 100,000. So anywhere you get your podcast, and if you don't know how to get that on your phone, stop any 10-year-old on the street, and they'll show you how to set it up.
And if you have a question for him right now, you can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Let's start with Medicaid, because we already are getting some questions in here. But our Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez said 276,000 Wisconsinites could lose their Medicaid coverage over the next decade because of some changes to Medicaid, cuts in Medicaid.
That's a big issue. And part of the issue is, you know, when the government starts really not supporting, we need some support for people on Medicaid, basically. It's governmental support. It's so short-sighted because those people will eventually get sick, they'll get ill, they'll be more expense when they actually have to go into the hospital. And it's a problem because the federal government in the last bill, the big, beautiful bill, which was not so beautiful, cut Medicaid support, and that's going to make a big difference in the state of Wisconsin. You know, we have to support those people who have difficulties, and often people who have less money have more illness. I mean, it's kind of a direct curve. You know, the more money you have, the more likely you are to buy fruits and vegetables, have a job which pays enough so that you can join a gym and take care of your health. So it's a big problem. Big problem.
I think Wisconsin alone faces about $7 billion cut in Medicaid over the next 10 years.
That's right. Unless there are changes. And, you know, medicine is not supposed to be political. It became political, you know, once COVID came in and people said immunizations were bad. And, you know, the rubbish that, you know, comes out of Washington is that, you know, immunizations are not good for you. It's a good example. So part of this is the fact that we're not supporting people that need to be supported. And I, of course, do not. I wish I had an answer. I wish I could have a magic wand, as you do, to actually do that. But I think one thing that you can say, even when it's cut, I think it's important to think about taking care of their health. And part of that is health literacy. Listening to public radio, learning about health like you are on your show, Larry, and then taking action to make sure they take care of their health. Because the real goal of good health is eating right, exercising, reduction of alcohol. In Wisconsin, we're number one for binge drinking. You know, people say, well, I don't drink that much during the week, and, you know, I drink on the weekend. And I'll never forget, I had a guy in my office, and I still fill in at SSM Health Dean Clinic a couple times a month. Guy came in the office and he said, I don't drink as much. And I said, what do you mean? Well, I don't drink during the week, but on the weekend, I drink a bit. I said, how much is a bit? Well, you know, I no longer have half a case of beer on the weekend. I just have like six when I'm sitting in front of the TV. And I thought, well, that's actually still a lot. But from his point of view, it wasn't. So it's cutting down on drinking, exercising, and that'll help health, because we can't fix the governmental issues. I certainly can't.
No. Summer's here. We welcome the warm weather, but certain health issues crop up this time of the year. Sun and heat is one, I guess. Sun.
So part of it, when we look at some, you know, when you go out in the sun, you want to use an SPF of 30 or above. So SPF 30 or above are good. Now, it turns out the federal government, when you look at lotions and oils and everything, that'll give an SPF number. Sprays are not as regulated, but I find them they're more aesthetically pleasing. So one of the things you want to do, if you want to have, you know, in the summertime, you want to have something on your face, go and try different things to put on your face that you like, because your face is going to get most of the sun. And I happen to like a stick that's made from Neutrogena. I just find it, I don't have to get my hands sticky. I can just put it on my face. And by the way, if you want to see what your body looks like, doesn't have any sun, pick up your arm and look at the bottom side of your arm. I'm lifting up my arm right now. I don't have my shirt off. And that's what your arm is like without sun. And then look at the part of your arm that has had sun. And that's the difference between how basically your skin would look like without sun. SPF for 30 of above, very important that works. When it comes to heat stroke, make sure you stay hydrated. But if somebody, you know, looks like they're having heat stroke, it's important to get them cooled off as quickly as possible. And one of the things I talk about, I write in my column that I always do in the middle of the summertime in the Wisconsin State Journal, is that if you feel like one of the kids are out there playing soccer and they may have heat stroke and they look like their things are just going off, you know, put them on a tarp, put all the ice on top of them, pour all the water and all the liquid to cool them down before the ambulance arrives. That's a really important thing. And we're going to see some heat stroke in Wisconsin. Not now, it's May, but it's going to come in June and July, and pay attention to it.
The other thing that comes with spring is pollen.
I get it.
Big temperature swings can trigger asthma attacks. Oh, how do you keep that under control?
Well, first of all, in your house, I mean, if it's like this time of year when lots of pollen are out there, close the windows, don't open them on, make sure your furnace filter is clean, and just keep it running 24/7. Because it'll filter out some of those little, you know, those low micron things so that you sleep better. That's a very important thing with pollen. So what do you do if you have allergies, first of all? Well, over-the-counter steroid nasal sprays like Flonase are now available without a prescription. That's the best stuff. One squirt in each nostril twice a day can make a big difference. If that works after a few days, go down to just one squirt a day. Over-the-counter antihistamines, Claritin, Allegra, Zyrtec, they're all generic. They all work. If they don't work, call your doctor or message on my chart your doctor or clinician and ask for something in addition to that. From an asthma point of view, it's a big issue. If you're starting to wheeze and you feel like you're having your asthma flare up, you often need to be on a daily inhaler this time of year. May not need it in the winter. And combination of inhalers with a steroid and something called a long-acting a beta agonist inhaler like Advair, that can make the difference in life and death. We still have a lot of asthma deaths in America today.
We do. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. We have a tremendous number. It has not gone down significantly in the last 20 years. It stayed up there. And that's caused pollution, among other things, and because people need to be on these daily inhalers, and they're not doing it because they're expensive. They're expensive. Yeah. And once again, that's because it's not paid for by things like Medicaid. They're not paying for inhalers. So you have it. People who often are poverty have lots of asthma, and it is a big issue. So if you need a refill on your inhalers, your daily inhalers, message your clinician to make sure you get that, and have your rescue inhaler on hand.
Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest today. Questions or comments for him, give a call. The number 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Paul in Merrill called but couldn't stay with us, but he has another issue that relates to this time of the year, and that's Lyme disease. He suffered from Lyme disease and wondering, is there actually a vaccine under development for Lyme disease?
Well, first of all, there are undoubtedly vaccines under development. There's nothing close to a vaccine at this particular time. And they may not ever develop that because Lyme disease is very similar. The bacterium that causes Lyme disease is analogous to the bacterium that causes syphilis. It's not the same thing, very different bacteria, but in the same class. Same case. Okay. And they've never been able to make a vaccine for syphilis. You've never been able to make a vaccine for syphilis, gonorrhea, or chlamydia, sexually transmitted diseases. We don't have vaccines for those. So Lyme disease, which is similar, the spirochete, similar bacterium, I'm sure it's under development. We don't have a vaccine for tuberculosis, which is actually the number one infectious disease killer in the world today. So there are many vaccines that we don't have. So with Lyme disease, what do? Make sure if you're in the woods, you look at your body when you shower in the evening time. The bacterium has to be on you. The tick has to be on there in order to get the bacterium into your body for more than 24 hours. If it's less than 24 hours, don't worry. If it's more than 24 hours, give a call to your doctor. Sometimes just 200 milligrams of an antibiotic called doxycycline will take care of it. But I'll give an example. I was giving a speech and I was sitting down. Somebody looked at my hat, pulled it off and said, "Look what's on your hat, Doc." And it was a tick, a deer tick. I wasn't in the woods. I was with my dog in the dog park. And there was a deer pit tick in the dog park. So, yeah, it's the season.
Well, and it's one of the worst in a while, I guess, for ticks.
Yeah, so. I have a question for you, Larry. Every year, everyone says this is the worst year.
It gets worse every year.
Maybe it gets worse every year. Don't they say, oh, this is the worst year for ticks? You know, maybe it just gets worse every year, but it's pretty bad.
Oh, man. Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Zorba Pastor. Right after the show today, I'll be jumping in the car and heading off to Green Bay to the Widener Center. And tonight at 7 o'clock, I'll be doing, with Jill Nadeau, we'll be doing another one of my end of career talks.
Nice. Yeah. No. End of this part of your career. End of this part of your career. You will always be involved in Wisconsin in one way or another. Oh. You're a Wisconsin boy. Yeah. You've been giving of your life to improve life in Wisconsin. It's not going to end here. It's a new beginning.
It's a new beginning. But in the meantime, we'll be at the Widener Center tonight at 7. You can still get tickets for that. They kind of moved the venue to a larger room within the within the Widener Center.
You must be popular. They moved it to a bigger venue. I don't know.
Well,
must be popular.
You can go to WPR.org/presents. Tickets are free, but we like to know how many are coming so we can adjust the amount of swag that we have to hand out, among other things. And it's it's an hour of talk and discussion and questions and a whole lot of laughter, and then there'll be some time for picture taking and all that after we're done. So looking forward to that tonight at 7 o'clock.
It's going to be great. You are great live. I mean, I'm in the studio with you now. If folks have never seen you, and many have not, they should come and see you tonight. Yes.
Well, sometimes people say, "Oh, I thought you were younger when they first see me, or I thought you were skinnier." And they'll go, "Oh, sorry." Oh, man, all this laughter. Actually, a listener emailed to say they just tuned in. I'm excited to hear both our voices. Thanks to both of us for what we've brought to public radio over the years, and let you know that you have brought a smile to their face for many years. So
nice.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Kimberly in South Beloit, Illinois, called, couldn't stay with us. She's a former vegetarian who is trying to improve her gut biome by eating fish and cottage cheese. She eats a lot of fruit, but worries that the sugar in fruit is contributing to her weight gain. She's struggling with knowing how to eat healthy. A former vegetarian again, trying to improve her gut biome.
Sure. Well, I think the Mediterranean diet is really the diet, that's the main diet that has been shown time and time and again to be the healthiest diet. So that means plentiful fruits and vegetables in a variety of colors. The more colorful the fruit is and the veggie is, the more micronutrients. Micronutrients follow color. Fish twice a week is excellent thing to do. Dairy products, those are the things. And, and a reduction basically in other animal products. If you wonder what it is, go to Wikipedia, look up the vegetarian diet. You can go to any bookstore or Amazon.com. you can look up Mediterranean diet for beginners. And I think that really does make a difference in the biome. We're just beginning to understand how much poop affects our health. We don't think about it. You know, we're kind of, you know, it's not been something that has been studied for obvious reasons. It's not something we'd like to deal with. But the more we know about it, the more we realize that these bacteria and other microorganisms that habitate our colon affect our entire life. Yep.
Dennis emailed to say that multiple diseases incubate and become more contagious, which is sickening more people who can't get necessary treatment. And this is back to Medicare and Medicaid.
Sure.
Without it,
right,
people won't be vaccinated and treated, mm-hmm, so disease spreads faster. Epidemics and pandemics have shown we need public health programs.
Absolutely. Now, it turns out the vaccines that are available right now under the federal government, they basically are supported differently in terms of money. So often you can get free vaccines.
Yeah.
That's what you can get. On the other hand, you got to know where to get them. So they may be in the public health building. Where's that? Well, maybe, I don't know where it is in Madison. Maybe it's, let's say, downtown Madison. Once again, I'm not sure. Well, maybe they're open from 9 to 5. Maybe you work from 9 to 5. We've never done in our state of Wisconsin, which we should do. We don't have vaccine trucks. We could do the same as Good Humor trucks. Go around, the vaccine truck goes to your neighborhood, it rings, ding, 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 and you can go and get a vaccine. We've never done that in our state. The problem with the state of Wisconsin, you've got vaccinations of children. So I'm going to ask you a question later. What states do you think are number one and number two in terms of vaccines for their children? Just take a guess.
Let's see. Oh, man. Which state?
Yeah.
California?
Yeah, that's what most people ask. California, maybe New York. No,
yeah.
No, Mississippi and West Virginia are number one and number two. And Wisconsin is number 49, 49 out of 50. And it has to do with the fact that Mississippi and West Virginia years ago said you can, you know, personal preference, you don't want your child vaccinated, that's okay. But we won't to get your child into school. But you have to go discuss it with a doctor, and that's okay. Once you had a discussion with the doctor, they can sign off and you can do personal preference. Once they put that step in, made a big difference. In the state of Wisconsin, if you take your kid to school and they're not vaccinated, you can say, oh, personal preference. And a lot of people just haven't done it for a bunch of reasons. So we're number 49, they're number one. We can make some changes, even with the changes in Medicaid. Isn't that shocking? Everyone says California, New York. They all say the same thing. They're in the middle of the pack. Mississippi and West Virginia. Proving that you can make, they made changes, public health changes. They were at the bottom
so
of the
people,
pack.
So people go, they talk to the doctor.
And then 95% of the time they go, oh, I never realized there weren't that many side effects. They get their kids vaccinated, right? Personal preference often changes when they talk to their clinician who they trust. That's the whole point. Talk to somebody who you trust, and then make your decision. And when you give people those choices, the good and the bad, they will end up choosing. It turns out 87-88% in all surveys of people, parents in this country, believe their children should be vaccinated for childhood diseases. And it doesn't matter if you're, red or purple or blue or green, no matter what the demography is, parents want their children vaccinated and want their other children in the school vaccinated so they don't get their kids sick. Yeah.
Eric emailed, this goes back to sunscreen for a minute here. Mm-hmm. He's heard that sunscreens with greater than 30 SPF are less effective than those with lower SPF. Is this true?
No, once you get SPF of 30 is good. You can go to 50. It just means there's more chemical in there. But once they're at SPF 30, they're effective. And there are two basic types of sunscreen. There's the sunscreen that really reflects the sun, like zinc oxide, you know, that will go on. You know, you look at lifeguards, and they put zinc oxide on their nose, make their nose white. But there are sunscreens that are reflective, and then the other ones that have uh, the the PABA, I think that's what it is, I can't remember, within the sunscreen itself. And then if you go to, if you want to know what the differences are, go to Wikipedia. But once you get to SPF of 30, you're okay. 50, you don't have to replace it quite as often, you know, but you've got to, if you're at the beach, you've got to do it every couple of hours because you sweat it off.
As we were talking about this, I was reminded about mosquito repellents.
Yes.
And I was reminded of it because a friend had some repellent in his tackle box next to some of his lures. And there was some leakage and whatnot, and they literally dissolved the worm-like plastic worms that he had.
In the lures.
In the lures. And he said, do I really want to put that on my body?
Well, it's kind of a question. I don't know which repellent he had, nor do I know which lures he had. But yes, there are some side effects also with the vehicle in the repellent. So you've got permethrin or DEET in there, and the vehicle might have been a more more alcohol-based vehicle. So it may not be the repellent, but it may have been the vehicle for the repellents. In other words, so you have two things, and the answer is yes. And you may want to spray it on your clothes and not on your face. People do that. Or you may want to use, for repellent, you may want to get the, not even the lotion, but you get the towelettes. So you're careful with that. Mm-hmm. You wash your hands afterwards. But basically, putting on your clothes is going to make a big difference, you know, spraying it, especially if you're in the woods. Do you get poison ivy, by the way?
No, I've never. I know what to look for. I'm careful about that. I did have a friend who bought a house over on the west side of Madison, and there were a bunch of weeds that she wanted to clear out. So it was summertime, and she went out there in her shorts and halter top, and it was all poison ivy.
I've got the story.
Oh, my goodness. Talk about suffering.
You know, leaves of three, let it be. Look and see what it is. And if you're going to pull weeds, glove up, long sleeve shirt, put the socks over your long pants if you don't know. You don't want to, because you can become allergic to poison ivy later on. It's not you can be fine, but you can develop an allergy. So, and then know what it looks like. So,
well, Chris emailed to say regarding the Mediterranean diet, your local library is also a great resource for that information, and it's
excellent.
Free.
Yes, that's right. It is free. And that's a good point. I mean, I said, get a book and have it at home. I was thinking the cookbook, if you have it at home and it's yours, you're more likely to cook from it. But yes, going to your local library and looking at it. That's a good point. Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest, questions for him, comment, maybe an experience to share, give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Well, last week there was some news of a deadly hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship, which I've never been on a cruise ship, and I, after watching that, I don't intend to start on a cruise ship.
You mean you're not going to retire and go on a cruise?
No, I'm not going to go on a cruise. What about, this is, I guess, some sort of rare strain.
Right.
That does spread
to
human, from human to human, but do we need to be worried about it here in Wisconsin?
No. the answer is no. So first of all, it is a deadly virus. It's a rare virus. We've known about it for a long, long time, spread by rodents. And this particular variation can be spread person to person. So they basically have quarantined them. And probably there have been other minimal outbreaks in the Southwest of hantavirus because that's really where it is. And if one person dies from it, you know, you don't necessarily notice that. If somebody dies and they get a pneumonia and they die, you just make an assumption that it was kind of from a normal viral pneumonia that caused it. But no, you don't have to. It's made a lot of news, I think, obviously because of COVID. They've put, those people are in quarantine. And I don't think we have to, we don't have to worry about it in our state. They've been quarantined. You don't have to worry. So I don't know. I don't know why it made. Well, I know why it made the news so much.
Yeah.
Because of COVID.
Anytime, of course.
I mean, that's why it made the news. 20 years ago, when it made the news, they would have quarantined people, and it would have been a, yeah, would have been a backstory. That's right. Do not worry about hantavirus. Worry more about wearing your seatbelts, not drinking too much alcohol, having nightlights in your house so you don't fall on the way to the bathroom, that you don't have throw rugs in your house, more likely to fall. There are a lot of things you can die from in Wisconsin. It's not going to be hantavirus.
Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Hello again. Can you tell me, does the date on sunscreen and bug spray, is it really an important thing? Do they expire?
No, I don't think they expire. The feds may put a date on it because they have certain rules where they put a date on things, but the chemical does not expire. No. So sunscreen, you know, if you have sunscreen from 10 years ago, it's still going to work. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, they have their own rules for dates, but as far as I know, it never really expires, no.
It's a good question, Barbara. It reminded me about, just about the medications you get. Sometimes it'll say...
Well, that's different. Well, medications, the feds say it has to have an expiration date. The reality is, if you look at aspirin and it's been measured 100 years later in the bottle, never opened, it never expires. But some drugs do expire, and there you've got to pay attention to it. The Fed expiration date... If there's an expiration date, the drug is really good for 6 months beyond that expiration date, generally. I say that generally.
Yeah.
And we're talking about drugs you get from your pharmacy, not hospital-type drugs, but not when it comes to things like this. But my daughter went into the basement and said, you know, your mustard has expired by a year. And I said, it looks good. She said, oh, no, Dad, it's bad. So, you know, what can I say? God bless her.
Oh, boy. Catherine, thanks, Barbara. Catherine and Stevens Point, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling, Catherine.
Thank you. I just wanted to let the readers know about an economical way of putting a tick repellent, insect repellent on their clothing. There is a commercial product for hunters that's called Sawyer's tick repellent, and it comes in a spray bottle. But the active ingredient in that is permethrin,
Permethrin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is, you can purchase that in a more concentrated solution in the livestock area or the veterinary area at like Fleet Farm and places like that.
Really?
And it gets the dilution. Or if you're good, you can do a little math. And it's only for clothing and bedding and things like that, but it really does help in addition to the insect repellent on your body when you aren't wearing clothing. For those long clothings, put it on the clothes. And supposedly, it says it can last through several washings.
Yeah, permethrin lasts for some time. So, in other words, get a concentrated bottle, save money, do the math. Not really difficult, but you could do the math. You can do it without AI. You can actually do the math yourself. You don't need to go to ChatGPT. You can multiply and divide like you did in elementary school and then put it on your clothing. Good point. Saving money is always great, and that's wonderful. And clothing is a great way to get rid of those insects. So.
Yeah. Catherine, thanks a lot for calling. I've actually sprayed it on... I didn't do the math. I bought this. I didn't know about this.
You sprayed it. Well, that's okay.
I've sprayed it on some of the clothes that I, you know, when I'm out hiking or if you, you know,
it's a great idea.
Or something.
Yes, right.
And it must work because it's the rare.
Well, it
time.
Does work. It does work. Yeah, permethrin on the clothing is definitely does work. There's no doubt about that.
You mentioned AI in passing there just a second ago.
I did.
And artificial intelligence has many applications in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Has the potential to, I think, help improve patient care.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. So, first of all, we've had AI for 75 years. 75 years. When I was out west, I was at a dude ranch. Remember encyclopedias? Remember those?
Oh yeah. We had a set.
We had a set too, like the Americana or something. So this was, remember they'd have a yearbook that would come out every year.
Yeah.
And it would be an update. And I was in this dude ranch looking at a 1953 encyclopedia, opened it up randomly, looked at an article, and it was about AI. They didn't call it AI. Denver had a problem when at 3:30 in the afternoon, when factories were getting out, they were getting stuck because the stoplights were going on and off on a timer. So they were going to try something called a mechanical brain. This was an early computer that worked on tubes like we're on TV, because the transistor had not been invented, and they were going to put sensors in the pavement so that the lights could go on and off based on how many cars were on the street. And they no longer had to have a policeman out there directing traffic. So the policemen and policewomen, although there are many, could do something else. That was AI. So AI is your colleague. So from a medical point of view now, with AI, if somebody comes in and I fill in at SSM Health at a variety of places, I can now push a button and get a summary of what's going on for the last year or two of that patient. And I've looked at those summaries, which I often read to the patient. It's about 200 words. It's a remarkable summary. Who they've seen, the medicines they've had. It's an incredibly good summary, and AI is not doing that. AI also, if I'm sitting with a patient and I'm on AI and I say, pardon me, can I have AI from my phone in Epic listen to? And people will say yes. If they say no, we don't do it. It'll give me a summary so I don't have to type it in. So that's incredibly good. So I can look at you and talk to you and listen to you. I don't have to enter it into the computer. Big step forward.
That's a big step.
Big step forward. And then it gives me a summary. I have to read the summary afterwards and correct it if there's anything. I don't have to type it in. The other thing is it may give me a recommendation when I'm saying I think it's this and that, a diagnosis, push a button, and it may say, have you thought about this or thought about that? So I think of AI as a young colleague who's sitting at the side of me, writing and typing and giving me recommendations. Because it's not always right. So a good example is a woman came in and it said she had, when I did the summary, it said suffers from depression. Well, she was on an antidepressant, not for depression, because it works in chronic pain.
Oh.
See? So you've got to read it because it made a mistake. And it looked at it and thought it was from depression. Once again, it's only a program. So it's 95% right, 5 or 10% wrong. You figure it out. You got to curate it. So that's what AI is going to do in medicine. It is a remarkably good step forward if you read it and use it with your human brain.
Yeah, that's where I heard some worry about AI.
Uh-huh.
With that, it would be really, or it could be really easy for somebody to say, I'm right. not going to pay, you know, it's all
cut
done
and
for
paste.
Me.
Yeah. Totally. That's exactly what it is. And that is the downside. And that is a true downside, where if you let it simply do things for you, it's going to make mistakes and you're actually going to get bad medical care. So like any other technology, there's an upside and a downside, and we as physicians have to use it in the appropriate way. And you as a patient has to do it. But imagine, a lot of people don't like going in the office, a doctor or nurse practitioner or PA, and say, well, they never looked at me. They just looked at the screen. Well, that's not good medicine either, right?
No, it is not. It is not.
Yeah.
And the other thing I've heard, and I frankly don't worry about it myself, but there's a concern among some about data privacy and disclosures and that sort of thing.
Well, the AI that we use will say, let's look at Epic, which is our electronic health record, you know, the major health record in the country. You don't have to be concerned about it because it's HIPAA compliant. In other words, the information, when you use AI within their system, it stays within their system. It's not outside. In other words, as a clinician, I am not using it. I am not allowed to use AI from the outside. I can only use AI from the inside of the system. When I'm when I'm using AI. Now, if I consult books and everything on the outside, I'm doing it the same way I ordinarily would do. But I think people should feel comfortable that their records are safe as of now.
As of now. Well, Brooke in Eau Claire has a question. It may relate to this or not. I'm not sure. Brooke, hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi. I love you both.
Thank you.
I have a question about SSRIs and the Trump administration and their take on that. What is your take on it, Zorba?
Well,
first, what are SSRIs?
Well, these are antidepressants. Okay. So what's your question about it? I mean, I'll tell you my take, but you mean their pushback on it or the recent thing that came out, the rubbish that came out a few days ago?
Well, I just know that I'm a nurse, and I have seen some patients who do have withdrawals from SSRIs.
Totally. And all antidepressants. What they did, RFK came out with something. And once again, it has some good points and some bad points. It said some people shouldn't be on antidepressants. And the answer is yes. In other words, you should be on a drug, and then you have to go over with your clinician whether you should stay on it or not. And too many people are on it that don't need it. Well, yeah, some people are on it that don't need it, but the problem is many people really need it. And I'll give a great example. When the first antidepressants came out in the early 1950s, called tricyclics, a psychiatrist did not embrace them. They said, no, you've got to get to the bottom of why you're depressed. Well, the answer is some people we now know just are depressed, and it's biochemical. And they said, no, you should undergo psychoanalysis. Well, who can afford psychoanalysis? And the answer is the upper middle class could afford psychoanalysis. And so they had to find a better way. It took them between five and 10 years before they embraced antidepressants. And I was never taught much about depression in medical school in the 70s. It was neurosis. So we did a good job. And the SSRIs, Prozac being the main one, were great drugs that came out. They were well tolerated. And so I think, like every drug, you've got to look at the benefits and the risks. And if you want to go off, or you think you should go off, or you think you've been on it too long, you talk to your clinician and make that decision. And that's what we should do with all of our medicines.
Yeah. Brooke, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Ellen in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Ellen.
Yeah, good morning. It's great to hear Dr. Zorba on the radio again.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. I had a very unfortunate personal experience with Lyme disease 2 years ago when it landed me in the emergency room.
Oh, wow.
I had been to my doctor 3 times over the past 6 weeks. She was treating me for cellulitis, and I know something was wrong. So ultimately, the emergency room visit, and the question that I asked was, I wonder how many doctors actually recognize it when they see it. I didn't have the classic bullseye rash. Mm-hmm. I did have a rash, however. And when they see it, do they know how to treat it and what the appropriate course of antibiotics is? So this was the big concern that I had when I got out of the emergency room, and I did file a claim with the state about the lack of treatment and training.
Uh-huh. There are a couple of things. First of all, the treatment is easy. You know, I mean, I think last time I looked, it was doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day. But the treatment is easy. It's easy to look up, even though the CDC website is on and off because of the present federal government's push against science and technology. You can still find the treatment very easily through a variety of sources, UpToDate being the one. The treatment is not complex. The recognition, as you bring up a good point, you can have Lyme disease and not have the bullseye rash, or it's pretty minimal. And so the recognition sometimes can be difficult because it's not, it's not a florid disease. Florid meaning, you know, it's not like in your face florid. So the recognition of it is not always easy. It can be sort of mild symptoms that you have. And the other issue is, when does the Lyme test turn positive? you've got the initial test, then you've got something called the Western blot, and it isn't positive. I'd have to look back at it. I don't know if it's 10 days or 2 weeks, but it's not positive right away. So it can be missed. You bring up a good point. So if you feel sick and you're not getting better, the issue is to go and, you know, the issue is talk to your clinician, your doctor, and you've got to get the Lyme test. And if not, sometimes you have to do it a week or 2 weeks later to find that out.
So there is a test for it.
There's a test for Lyme disease, but you can get the disease and the test can still not be positive. That's part of the the antibodies are not in your system yet. You know, it can be what's called a false negative if you get it early on. But you also have to think about it. Somebody can come in with innocuous symptoms. But the issue is sometimes it's that second time the person comes in that you go, well, I don't know what this is. It's around Lyme time and Lyme disease time and you do it. So
yeah,
it's not always that simple.
Dr. Zorba Pastor, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Dr. Zorba Pastor, and he has a new podcast out. It's called Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. And
that's right. I love doing it. It's a good step, with public radio, which I did for almost 35 years, and the podcast, it's a 20-minute podcast, and then we give updates when things come out of Washington. Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. If you just put my name in Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, that'll work. And if you don't know how to put a podcast on your phone, ask a teenager, and they'll get it done lickety-split.
Lickety-split. There you go. Kurt in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. I was going to start off with a comment. I used to, I had beads for about 30 years, and I was so comfortable with them that I didn't wear the veil. I didn't wear the gloves. Ooh. Worked with them all the time. Mm-hmm. Then about 6 years ago, one nailed me on the back of the hand, and my thought was, oh, poor bee, it's going to die. Well, about 10 minutes later, I noticed that where my fingers had been, sausages went all over there. And so you were talking
poor
about...
you.
You were talking about developing allergies late in life, and that happened to me.
Right.
The question I've got is for Dr. Zorba. Do you have any good asparagus recipes? Because I've got it coming on my ears right now.
Not off the top of my head, but I do love asparagus. At one point, when I moved into the place that I still have in Fitchburg, I put in 50 asparagus plants and tendered them, got lots and lots of asparagus. I was sort of a young gardener doing that, and I didn't realize that the trees that I planted near the asparagus plants would eventually, so we don't have any asparagus anymore, and I've got tall trees. So I buy them. So send them on in. I love asparagus. I just love it.
Yeah. You know what I do? Oftentimes, if I've got some asparagus, and I'm going to grill, I will just...
Oh, wow. That's right.
I'll take a chicken breast, a boneless chicken breast, and I'll put that on the grill, and I'll take the asparagus, and I'll put a little oil on it, olive oil, and then I will kind of roll it or throw it in a bag with some Parmesan cheese.
Ooh. Oh.
And that's it. And then I put the...
On the grill.
I've got one of these little plate things so they don't fall through.
Right.
But you put the breast of chicken on and you put the asparagus on and they both get done at the same time.
I'm coming over for dinner. That's it.
I'm coming over for dinner.
That's what I want. I love it. It's simple and delicious and healthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you bring up, it's such a good point that you can eat well and follow good food and still have wonderful food and improve your diet. That's a great diet.
Takes a minute.
Yeah, it takes a minute.
To do it.
I'm ready. I'm coming over.
So there's my recipe for you, Kurt. And I do that a lot because I enjoy grilling outside anyway.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Susie in Altoona. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell Dr. Zorba that I was on his very first program,
and I asked him a question. Oh, can you imagine that?
Really?
And you really had problems answering it. Can you believe it?
Oh, my God,
and I can
really?
Tell you the answer you gave me. Yeah, the answer was, the question was, my husband has dry eyes, and what can they do for it? And back then you said, wash his eyes and do nothing. And my reply was, my reply to that was, but you're a doctor. You have to help me.
Well, I don't remember the question nor the answer, but I can. But I love the fact that you were one of my on my first program, which is way cool.
Yes,
now
I
would say I probably also said if it's dry, wash your eyes with a couple of drops of Johnson's baby shampoo to wash the
sure.
lids.
Mm-hmm.
If they were dry, that was it. Now I would say, put in some artificial tears like Refreshed, which
yes.
I like, and then put on a microwave mask that is warmed up in the,
yeah.
The microwave. I would do things differently. Hey, after 35 years, I learned something.
35 years, we were just children, weren't we?
Yes, we were. Those were the days, my friend. We thought they'd never end.
Oh, man. Susie, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is way cool. That is way cool.
Martha in Menominee, your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Dr. Zorba. See, I got a question for Dr. Zorba. I had Lyme disease a few years ago. I talked to Dr. Zorba about it. And he said, I had it three times. He said, what are you, a forest ranger? Well, I wasn't, but... since then, I've healed. I got the treatment, and I haven't had any relapse. But have a brain aneurysm this past summer, a year ago. And they put me on an anti-seizure drug called Keppra.
Keppra.
I did have a seizure with it, too. And I was on it for, a couple weeks, and then I tried to kill my husband.
Oh,
and
well, that's
I found
not good.
Out about this phenomenon called Keppra rage. And I was wondering, Dr. Zorba, if you have any patients who have taken this drug.
Well, Keppra is a commonly used, well-tolerated drug for seizures. But like all drugs, there can be side effects. So I wasn't familiar with that particular side effects. But I'll give you an example of a statin side effects. I had a patient of mine, and it gave him dreams, nightmares, and often he would then become very combative in bed with his wife because he had these nightmares from that. And she tried different statin drugs and did not tolerate that. And that turns out to be a very unusual but well-documented side effect for statins. So Keppra rage and others, I'm not familiar with it, but it may be present in more than one drug. And it had to be very awful, the idea of that. So I cannot imagine how you figured that out, and that had to be an awful thing for you.
Martha, thank you for calling and bringing that up. Appreciate it very much. We had Grant email, by the way, to suggest on the asparagus side, make a yeasted asparagus bread.
Ooh. Oh.
Or,
that's a great idea.
Yeah, or make an asparagus puree to dress pasta.
That's excellent. Or
and the puree freezes, too.
Or stand outside of your house and say, free asparagus, and people will definitely take you up on it.
Asparagus bread. I hadn't thought of that.
I like it. Never had it. I've never had it. It's a great idea. I'd love to try it.
In the last 20 seconds, is intermittent fasting healthy?
Yes.
A listener wants to know.
100%. Definitely healthy. And a number of studies have shown that it's very good. So I definitely support intermittent fasting. 100%.
On that happy note.
That's it. That's it, Larry.
You'll be back in a month or two.
I'll be back in a month or two, and you'll be listening on the radio.
That's
what you'll be doing. So thank you for having me.
Zorba Pastor, Dr. Zorba Pastor, take a look at his podcast called Stay Well with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Big thanks to you for listening. As always, a big thanks to our producers, Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, technical directors, Jeff Robbins, and Lee Rayburn, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store right through the afternoon here on WPR News. Stay with us.